Joe presents Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello and you're very welcome to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe, together with Guinness. We have a ton of stuff to get through on today's show. We'll be joined by Claire McLaughlin, Ulster and Ireland rugby player, who is also a doctor and working in the A&E department in the Ulster Hospital in Belfast, right on the front line for COVID-19. We'll also be joined by South African legend and Rugby World Cup winner, Victor Matfield, all the way from South Africa. We've got a lot of Penguins to give shouts out to this week, Trimby. They've been just going above and beyond. We also have our classic album and our classic movie, which are No Need to Argue by The Cranberries and Groundhog Day from my favourite Bill Murray. And we will be looking back at the Lions versus South Africa second test 2009. Trimby, it's day 36 in isolation for me. And I'm well settled in now. I don't know how many days it's been for you, not as many, but how are you holding up?
Yeah, a few days less, but it's the novelty hasn't worn off yet. In fact, I'm just settling in more and more every Monday. This is the time of the week whenever I get out of my pajamas and I put on. Well, when I say get out of them, I put a t-shirt over them.
Imagine you got a super tight pajama top.
Yeah. So this is the one.
I have my reindeer. Oh, jeez. I nearly fell off my chair. I have my reindeer pajamas still on from Christmas.
Wow.
So I just put my shirt on.
You're in a pair of knickers last week, so
I did.
You're getting back to some structure. Yeah, but for me, it's just been a week of barbecuing, gardening, and parenting. it's Groundhog Day
in that order. Yeah, all Groundhog Day is just the best film to watch. Thank you for suggesting that.
Yeah, so it's for me, it's just getting into that routine and becoming less and less productive. Reading plenty, watching plenty, but just in terms of actually getting any work done, nothing. It's brilliant. I've got a little bit better around the house, though. I'm not very good. DIY is not my thing at all. I could if I wanted to, I just can't. Sorry, I don't want to. So never mind. I would just ask my dad if I wanted to find out how to do it. Yeah, 35 years old. I'm a father of three and I'm still asking my dad for help.
Oh, yeah.
Why? But so I've just been, I bleached the drive the other day. I've been.
I did that.
Yeah, I did in gardening. Mm-hmm. I've had a strimmer for a while, but I've only really just started using it.
Mm.
I feel so manly and untypically me holding my strimmer and strimming the grass.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where I like finished it and I'm looking around and thinking, what else can I strim around here? If the neighborhood cats arrive when I'm holding that strimmer, they're getting strung.
Yeah, that's violence. That's what you call that. Animal abuse.
Yeah, but it's way, way less serious than...
I did have a similar moment with the power hose and the cat last week. I didn't.
I didn't power piss the cat.
My week, I've been incredibly lucky that I've been proper lockdown. Like, I haven't gone to the shops in 36 days. Morley goes to the shop. Now, that wasn't by choice. It just kind of happened that way. But this week we had to bring the babies to get vaccinated. So we had to go out and go into town. And it was like that time when you come home from holidays and everything has changed. Remember when you were younger and you come home from holidays? So it was good though. It was nice to get out. I was like, oh, do you remember that place? Remember that? Oh, look at that. And then I saw people that I knew. Remember that guy? Do you remember that fella, that weird guy that walks around the place?
Even in Limerick, it was still impressive.
Oh, it was so impressive. You know, just seeing buildings and stuff that I hadn't seen.
was the vaccination two stabs to both thighs?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's tough. It's hard to watch, isn't it? Tough.
I didn't have to watch now. I stayed in the car or I went in with them, but they were traumatized after.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Look, they'll toughen up. Exercise wise, how's that going for you? I've tried the feckin' Well, we've created a monster here because people keep getting on to me now, telling me, giving me things to do exercise wise. I tried your 100 burpees in, and I got to like 8 minutes something. I'm so shit at burpees. They're not for me. So I did, however, I very fortunately live within 100 meters of quite a few Monster Rugby players. So JJ Hanrahan and Ronan O'Mahony live within 100 meters of me. And we all socially distancing got together on the local green area and stayed 10 meters apart, and they were doing their interval running. So I joined in. Now, do you know what's the opposite of evolution?
Devolution?
Evolution?
I think that's the handing over of weapons.
That'll do. It's like, you know, the evolution chart with the man with a Homo erectus and all that. It gets to...
It's handing over of powers, actually. Sorry.
It's handing over of what?
Handing over of powers.
Powers.
Sorry.
It was kind of similar to that.
Yeah.
Where you got JJ Hanrahan, who is the most, you know, athletic out of the three of us, and he's like looking really good, lean, quick, had all the good gear on, all the latest gear, white boots and stuff like this. And then you'd run the man who's recently retired, who was like maybe 10 yards behind him. And then you had the 36-year-old washed up professional who's a good 20 yards behind both of them, wearing like, I didn't even have a pair of boots. I just had a pair of like old, indoor soccer shoes.
Oh, Sambas.
Yes. Yeah. Man, picture me now. Pair them.
Cigarette. Pair my, you have to have a cigarette.
A pair of my dad's black socks from his sock drawer. A pair of Bermuda shorts and like this gammy old t-shirt that I just had with some sort of surfer dude on the front of it. And the lads, I was so far behind, but I enjoyed the throwback. We did, Bowden Barrett posted a video of him doing this fitness thing.
Oh, last the Bronco. Week. Was it Bronco he was doing?
Bronco was the middle one, yeah. So that was tough. But I got through. There was like zigzags for 100 meters up the field. Yeah. You have to do it as quick as you can, then Broncos, and then 20, 40, 60 shuttle, or no, 50 meter shuttles, because the Broncos are 20, 40, 60. So yeah.
I assumed you couldn't run. That was what was your career end, or was it
a foot metatarsal injury in my foot?
Yeah.
So it does get floppy. I've got a metal plate across the front and across the side of my foot, so it does get quite floppy. JJ's fit. Shit.
Yeah, really.
He was about a second behind Bowden Barrett most, and he was quite disappointed with that. But Bowden Barrett's like back three, as opposed to being your stereotypical out half style fitness, yeah. Right?
He's supposed to be unbelievably fit as well, Bowden Barrett.
Yeah, I was given and Ron O'Mahony, aka Mankey, is doing shitloads of CrossFit, so he's a bit of a machine as well.
You jumped in the deep end there. You should be training with Killer, no?
Killer's just eating barbecue, man, and doing like doing the odd bit of weights, but that's a good call. I might get him out. He'd be more down my line.
Yeah, but did you see, having watched the Lions in 2009,
mm-hmm.
the big thing that struck me was just how physical and how chunky all of the South Africans were. Mm. They just kicked the crap out of the Lions. They just like Jacques Ferry, especially in the centre, was just bashing guys. Victor, yeah. Who were getting on, was killing people. I think Killer's probably got the right idea. Just get massive, and then anybody comes anywhere near you.
I think Killer's a devil for getting lean, though, isn't he?
Is he?
As opposed to getting massive, yeah.
He doesn't look that lean.
He likes the idea of getting lean, anyway. That's very true. Other than that, a big shout out to Mark Hill, our penguin, who I have to get him in early because he drew, made a drawing of us, which is was a creation from Michelangelo from the Sistine Chapel, and it's me reaching over to you. And he had included the porn. I was holding the porn that my parents had and my dad had in his sock drawer.
Are we going to have the weekly apology, by the way?
Yeah, they were a bit disappointed in me again
every week. They need to stop being disappointed, and this is what they're going to expect, another porn story.
So I went and watched the porn because Mark Hill found what it was actually called, and I went and watched it. Watched bits of it anyway.
Yeah.
And it brought me way back. It's called Domination. There's a character in it that I just remembered that he looks exactly like Emmanuel Petit, the center midfielder for Arsenal in France. Yeah. And it was in and around that time when he was playing for Arsenal that I used to watch this. So I used to skip through that scene. It's a bit weird watching Emmanuel Petit. So I watched it. And then I got my mother's book on.
I like the idea of your mum becoming a massive Arsenal fan. What's going on here, mum? Why are you watching so much Arsenal?
she didn't watch the porn. She didn't watch the porn. Okay, let's get Victor Matfield on the show.
You're listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness.
All right, we're delighted to be joined by Victor Matfield, all the way from South Africa. Victor, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us this morning. And, you know, we have a lot to get through in terms of your career and all that. But first of all, how are you doing? How is lockdown in South Africa and how are the family?
Yeah, we're doing fine. I must say, actually enjoying the family time. My oldest daughter is 14 now, and my middle one 11. And the three of us, we train together quite hard. So yeah, it's nice to spend time with them. Being more with them than normal. But start of week four, I think all of us are getting a little bit crazy at the moment. We just want to get out of here. We want to see our friends. We want to get out and have a nice dinner at a restaurant or something. But we're all safe and healthy at the moment.
And can you get out at all? Sorry.
What sort of training are you doing with your daughters?
So I've got a watt bike that me and my oldest daughter will use as well. And then I've got a driveway of about 70 meters. And we do a lot of shuttle running there. And then, a lawn that's about 40 meters. So most of it is shuttle running. And, just body exercises.
Jeez, they're keeping you on your toes, Victor.
I must say it's bad because you get to that stage where your 14-year-old is quicker than you. You can't keep up anymore. That's a problem. Trying my best.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And what kind of lockdown have you got there? Are you able to get out at all?
Yeah, we're actually in full lockdown. So you're only allowed to go for groceries to the closest grocery store. And then essential services can get out. Luckily, I'm in auctioneering. We do cattle auctions. So they see me as a essential service. So I've been out once or twice where I went to some of our clients' farms. But for the rest of us, we are all locked down. We're not allowed outside our houses.
Wow. So when you say you're going walking farms, or are there actually still cattle marts going on, or what's that about?
Just say again, sorry.
Is it like a cattle market that's going on, or are you walking farms, or what exactly do you do when you get out?
Yeah, it's more like auctions. So we do online auctions mostly. So we go and we see the cattle and we do stud auctions, to do wiener auctions, all of that. And then we do wild game auctions as well, where guys sell their animals to hunting farms.
Wow, pretty cool. And where are you based over there, actually?
I'm still in Pretoria, so still Blue Bulls country, where I've played my whole career. I stay in the east of Pretoria on a golf course, golf estate called Silver Lakes. So it's very tough to have the golf course right in front of you and you're not even allowed to go onto it. It's pretty tough.
Okay. Well, look, as I said, we've a lot to talk about. You've had a pretty astonishing career. You're the South Africa's most capped player at 127 caps, World Cup winner, a series winner over the Lions, which every week we decide to pick a game that we like to talk about, because obviously there's no live sport. And this week we've picked the second test versus the Lions in 2009 that we'd love to talk to you about later on. But look, you were renowned for, I suppose, your incredible athleticism throughout your career. But we had your former teammate, John de Villiers, on to us this week, who wanted us to remind you of when you first started, that you weren't maybe as much of an athletic second row, more of a bit of a fat second row, if that's correct.
Thanks, John. Before, I must say, when I started, I think my first test I played for South Africa was probably around about 120 kgs. And then after, I think it was 2004, end of the year tour, I missed out on the tour because I was injured. And then I lost close to 10 kgs in a month's time. So then, yeah, stayed off. So a bit different. I was more of a ball carrier in the beginning of my career. And at the end, I rather passed the ball to bigger guys around me.
Yeah, he said you came back with the long model flowing hair, a lot leaner, and you used to dye your beard as well to hide the grey patches as well.
See, I had to do all of that to play so much in the centres. I didn't like to go into the ruck, so I had to look like the pretty boys at the back. I had to get the long hair, tone up a little bit. And the grey didn't look, especially when you come back and you're 35, you can't be too grey. You know?
He also, just one last thing from John de Villiers was, which I think is so good. He used to call you the Great Cali, which is the WWE wrestler. Which
sounds like I need to send some videos of John de Villiers scrawling in the hotel floor guys, just to make sure we talk about all these flaws as well.
Yeah, well, he's going to be coming on in the next couple of weeks, so you've got the next 20 minutes to think of anything that you want to but look, do take us back to that time of your career, because you come in and under with Mark Andrews as your second row partner. And what kind of profession were you back then? Did you learn a lot off him in those first few years?
Yeah, I think you learn from everyone. I think you learn from coaches, you learn from other players. The one guy probably as a player I took the most from was Rassie Rasmus. When I started out playing Super Rugby, I actually went for 2 years. I went to a smaller union. I played for the Cats back then, or the Lions and the Cheetahs and the Greek was combined into one team. And Rossi was one of the senior players then. And he was probably the first guy that really got stuck into analysing the opposition. I remember walking into a video session on a Monday morning, and Laurie Mains, where I coached back then, and they would prepare for a team we're going to play. And Rossi would have done all the analysing already. And he would have had a few plans already when we got to that Monday meeting. And I think that's where I probably started picking things up, starting to do analyzing myself, going and have a look at the other oppositions, find out what do they do on their own ball, what do they do when it's out ball, how do they contest, and almost work out a plan before the coaches do that. So I think I learned a lot from Rossi. Mark Andrews were a fantastic player. I think hard graft, the guy that we're always running in front. So, yes, you take something from everyone. But like I said, if I look over my careers, when I was young, probably a guy like Rossi. And when I got older, myself and Frieda Priya really became close mates. So the two of us spoke about rugby, about tactics for hours by ourselves. And he was another guy that had a big influence in my career as well.
Did you ever think back then that Rossi would go on to become what he is now, you know, have such an impact in Munster and then move back home and then just completely change South African rugby? And, you know, he's put up clips on Twitter and you've kind of seen a little bit what he's like behind the scenes, but he's kind of lauded, you know. Did you expect he would become the Rossi that we all know now?
Well, I always hoped a guy like Rossi will get involved in coaching. And I think that's probably where you miss out. You get a lot of players that go into coaching afterwards. But a lot of the time, that it's not the players when you played that had the influence. It was the guys thinking about the game, talking about the game, almost making the plans for the coaches. It's a very few of them that you really see going into coaching. If I take over my career, Rossi is probably one. But I mean, if Rita Priya isn't coaching at the moment, John Smith isn't coaching at the moment, John de Villiers isn't coaching at the moment. Those were the guys that will sit in a room and you'll discuss, listen, team tactics and where we're going, what are they doing, and probably giving plans to the coaches as well. So that's great to see Rossi going into that role. I played with him as a youngster, but then I played against him as well. He was also the coach. He went straight out of playing into coaching the Cheetahs. And that was the time when the Bulls were really on a high. We won 3 Curry Cups in a row. We were going for our 4th, and we lost in the final against a team that was coached by Rossi Erasmus. And he started with all the lights on the roofs, almost making all the calls and all this tactics and all these changes with 4 front rows back then. Was you never had that. And I always thought out of the box. But yeah, it was great when he came back to South Africa, because you've got this guy that's very creative, but he also understood the strengths and the DNA of South African rugby. Coming back saying, listen, we can't play a New Zealand style of rugby if we want to beat New Zealand. We have to go back to our own strengths. We have to see what we are strong at. And he really believes in his tactics. And the players believe him because he's such a clever guy when it comes to rugby. The senior players can sit with him and they can argue and they can talk about stuff. And most of the time, he knows more than them. So that's always great. It's not always that you get a coach that knows more than the senior players. So it was great to see Rossi there. And let's hope we keep on doing really well.
With that in mind, with the World Cup just under your belt, and does that bring you back memories of your own achievements in 2007? You know, when you look through that team and you listen to you talk about some of the experience you had, is there a lot of kind of similarities you see between your approach in 2007 to how Rossi approached last year?
Yes, I think so. If you look at our 2007 team, we also came out of 2003 World Cup where things really didn't go well. South African rugby didn't know where they were going. And then Jake White came in, and Jake had a plan. Jake is a guy that really looks at stats, and he had a look at the previous 2-3 World Cups, exactly how experienced a team must be, what age group you need to have at the World Cup, to have those guys performing at the top level. So he had all that things he believed in. And he came in, I remember the first day he arrived, and he said, listen, 2004, first day we got together, he picked a lot of that young group that played under 21 for him. And he said, listen, we're going to win the 2007 World Cup. This is my plan. This is where we need to get to. We need to get 60% of the guys between 30 and 50 test matches. We need 4 or 5 guys with experience close to 80 test caps. All those things that were very important for him. And he kept to that belief of him. And again, I think we went through a very difficult time in 2006. We lost a few games and people wanted to fire Jake. And I think if he didn't believe in himself that much, he probably could have made a few changes and went away from his plan, but he didn't. He stuck to what he believed in. I think Rossi did the same. When he came in, he only had 2 years. We were really, really struggling as a Springbok team. But he got in there. He had his beliefs. He told the guys how they're going to win the World Cup. He laid out a plan for the next 24 months, and he stuck to that, and the guys believed in it. And we've said a lot of the time, doesn't matter what plan you have, if all the players, all the management buy into it, the chances of having success is so much bigger than chopping and changing your plans all the time.
Well, and would that be the standout kind of, I suppose, moment for you, winning Man of the Match in the World Cup final? I know you're probably, you know, it's when you're playing, it's not something that you take on, that you win Man of the Match, but it's not every day someone puts in a Man of the Match performance in a World Cup final to win. But is that the most outstanding achievement you think you've had?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think it's a great honour for me to have received that Man of the Match in a final. But when you're in that moment, you're just so happy that you've won the World Cup. It's like a sideshow almost. I think if you look back at your career and you look at special games that you played in and where you were man of matches, been something like that, of course, that will stand out. There will be other games where you thought you had a bigger impact and that was personally probably better for yourself. But, looking back at your career and being able to say you've been in a World Cup final, you were man of the match when you won the World Cup, that's very special.
Yeah, I've enjoyed watching a few of your long-distance tries that you ran in over the years. If anyone wants to check them out, I'd recommend looking up a few YouTube clips. I also loved seeing Brent Russell. I was a huge fan of his. Remember him, Trimby?
He went to Claremont then, didn't he?
Claremont, yeah. Yes. He was. I remember when you first, that team that you had, like 2004, 2005, there was Sky Sports had really kicked on over here, and we saw a lot of you, the Southern Hemisphere rugby, and I was like, he is the fastest human being that has ever lived. He was kind of ahead of his time in terms of his size and his speed, right?
Never ever started a game.
Yeah,
everyone wanted him to come off the bench with 40 minutes or 30 minutes to go. Everyone's a little bit tired, and there's the pocket rocket that, like we call them here in South Africa, and it was so great. The one try at Newlands, he ran probably about 70 meters, beating 10 guys, and then he passed on the inside to myself. When I scored the try, and I got best try of the year in South Africa. So thank you, Brent. Really appreciate that. I didn't do a lot. But yeah, just, and again, if you look at this team we had this year and at the World Cup in Japan, it's, yes, size does matter, but if you've got guys like with feet and with speed, they can just do magic things for you on the outside.
Love your other teammates, Victor, in particular. I'm thinking like the combination of you and Bakis Botha was, you know, a pretty well established relationship. And I don't know if it's maybe an oversimplification, but were you the brains and he was the guy who just beat people up? And like, is that an oversimplification? Because having watched the Lions series back again, it looked like you were beating people up as well. So how did that combination work?
No, it's probably exactly like you called it. Bucky's never wanted to do any homework on anything. When you came to a Wednesday before a game and someone asked Bucky's, listen, Bucky's, what are they going to do? He said, I don't know. Victor will tell me by Friday. Don't worry. So it was probably pretty much like that.
That's the way we run the podcast, actually, as well, Barry. That's his role.
See, yes. Exactly. So, I had to do all the work, all the hard work, but it was so great to have a guy like him there. Although he was this big, strong guy, especially in his earlier years, he was very mobile. He was quick. Line-out time as well. Could go very high as well. So it was great playing with him. And, he was the enforcer. I remember going into that 2009 series, I think. I don't know if it was Paul O'Connell, one of the media guys, before that Durban test that said, listen, maybe Victor and Bakis are past their best and it's time for this new Irish pair to come through. And I remember Bakis and I just looked at it and I just saw Bakis' laugh and I knew, okay. Don't say something like that to Bakis Botha. So, it was great to get him charged up as well. And a fantastic play. If you look at his career, after he was almost done in South Africa, he went to Toulon and almost played the best rugby of his career. It was a bit slower over in France, but, to win another three European championships with Toulon is just fantastic. So, it was pretty much like that. He liked to get involved in the rucks. I like to stand in the back line with John de Villiers in the centre, so that helped a lot as well.
I remember hearing you telling a story about that one. I think it might have been the second test when himself and Mike Bakis and Mike Phillips had a little bit of an altercation at a ruck.
I remember Mike Phillips looking up and he was talking about himself and Piers Peace and I think Skolberg and said, are you guys on stairs or whatever? And Bakis would just look at him and say, I love your beautiful blue eyes. Only thing he came back to was Mike Phillips. So, he had a thing for scrum offs, so Bakis. So he went and said hi to Jimmy Cowan at some stage with the forwards. So it's something he had for the scrum offs.
It was like another time watching that back. It was like another sport. And so you got into a row with Mike Phillips early on as well, and then you got into a row with O'Driscoll as well, and then everybody piled in behind, and the ref sorted it all out, and he says there was no close fists, I was going at least three. Drinko got punched at least twice, and someone else got punched. I think it was Joan.
Yeah, I must say, I think it was so funny going into the second test. We were so charged up, and I don't know why, but there was something in the week that Brian said, and I was just, I just said, there's no chance. This guy's just getting away with everything. I think it probably still came from the previous one where Donal Manga got into so much trouble with these tipping Brian. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It was just something that week that I was looking for Brian, actually. And when the opportunity arises, it happened. But I said to plenty of guys, if you look at Bucky's career over the years, and if they went back to the slow-mo, the amount of, we call it head cleans, where he cleans guys, but he makes contact with his head straight in the face to the other guys. He would have been suspended every game. He was looking for that the whole time. And if you think about that clean on, where he went off the field, it was one of the Jones props.
It's just Geoffrey Jenkins, maybe, I think it might have been.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Was it?
The force that Bucky's went into attracts him.
Yeah, Adam Jones broke his arm.
Adam Jones.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, it was one of the most physical games I've ever seen. Anyway, looking back at it, and I think it's one of those games that you'll always remember where you were when you watched it, and especially the way it finished. Can you take us back to those last 10 minutes when it was kind of going tit for tat, the Lions were leading, and then I think Jacques Ferry scored in the corner, then Lions got a penalty, and then a minute to go, Raj kind of gets in that awkward position where he's not looking, didn't see where the ball was, and I can't remember who he took out in the air, but, you know.
It was Dupree.
What was that, that last 10 minutes like?
Yeah, I think if we think about that game, it was at Loftus where we play the Blue Bulls, and we won the Super Rugby 2007 and 2009. We won Super Rugby by about, 58-3 or something, a record winning margin in the final. And we went into the game at Loftus not picking Mornay Steyn at 10. Mm-hmm. And Peter de Villiers picked Ruan Pina, who was a fantastic scrum off at 10, and he was a fantastic five as well. There was a lot of things going on. And then we almost had the slow start. We in the first stage, we had a great start, and we were behind. We were almost out of it. Probably very lucky that Skalkberger didn't get the red card as well in that first 5 to 10 minutes. But, Jacques Ferry also coming off the bench. It was one of our World Cup Euros in 2007, also from the bench. I think it was one of those games where a lot of people always talk, and now a guy like Rassi, about his bomb squad. And we really had a bomb squad coming off the bench and guys making an impact. And Jacques Ferry was probably one of the most underrated centres in world rugby. He was probably one of the best rugby players I played with. Mm-hmm. And coming on, scoring that try, I don't think there was any other player at that stage in world rugby who would have scored that try. And then we got the penalty. Close to 60 meters out, and we had Frans Steyn there that could kick it. But I just knew with Mornay Steyn at Loftus, you haven't missed a kick the whole year. It was easy to throw to Frans and say, this is a long kick. And Mornay just took that kick and he kicked it on. He probably have been 10 meters back and still have gone over. So, for me, that was one of the most special moments. People talk about World Cups and British and Irish Lions, but that moment was very close to winning a World Cup.
Wow. Mm. And then I suppose looking ahead to next year's Lions tour, 2021, how are South Africa looking for that? Are there any young up-and-coming players that we could expect to see?
Yes, it will be interesting to see what Rassi does, because it's so close. We've won the World Cup. And I think if you look at that team that played there, Skalk Brits isn't involved anymore. The only other oak that's probably on the edge, and Francois Lowe retired as well, is probably Dwayne Vermeulen. But he's coming back to South Africa. He wasn't sure if he's going to keep on playing, but I think he decided he wants to play against the British and Irish Lions. And he's such a big influence for that team. Not just what happens on the field, but off the field as well. He's probably Sia's right-hand man, making all the big decisions. So, yeah, I think Dwayne is the one guy. He's coming back to play Super Rugby to get ready for the British and Irish tour. And then we'll probably go with pretty much the same team that we've seen at the World Cup. Of course, there will be one or two new guys coming through. But I think if you look at the team, they'll probably be very close to the 22-23 that played in the World Cup final.
Brilliant. I suppose, taking it back closer to home for us then, what are your memories of playing against Ireland? And I presume you've had many battles with Paul O'Connell over the years.
Yeah, I don't have many great memories there. I haven't won a lot of games against Ireland in Ireland. I've said it at many occasions, Paul's probably the best player I've played in my position, especially when it came to line-out. It also helped him a lot, I think, when Gert Smal joined, and I worked with Gert for 4 to 6 years, and Gert knew exactly how I thought about the line-out, and I believe he definitely shared that with Paul O'Connell. So it was always very difficult to go up against him because he almost knew what I was thinking, especially in the years where Gert was there. And he was also a guy that studied the game, and I think he studied the lineouts as well. So he was going up against someone that was prepared, and a great guy off the field as well. Always had time for him afterwards. He was definitely my toughest opponent. And I must say my worst day of my career was going up against Ireland. I think it was 2009, after we had this great year. The Bulls won Super Rugby and Currie Cup. We won British and Irish Lion, beat New Zealand 3 times. Won the Tri Nations back then. So we had this fantastic year. And then we came up against Ireland and we played it with a big stadium, and the mist was there. You couldn't see the ball.
Yeah.
And
Croke Park, yeah.
For the first time in my life, I lost like 5 line-out balls against Paul O'Connell. And I wanted that after that game, I didn't want to get out of my room. I just want everyone to leave me because that has never happened to me before. But I think always great going up against them, and probably my best memory was I think it was 2010 when I captained the Springboks for a victory over Ireland, and pity then we lost against Scotland and we beat England as well, otherwise we could have had the beating all the nations.
Run. I suppose not many people will may not remember this, but you took a 2-year hiatus then in 2013 you retired, was it?
So after the 2011 World Cup, I retired. And then, January 2012, I didn't know Henneke May was going to be the next Springbok coach. He called me immediately and asked, won't I come back? He wants me to captain the Springboks for 2 years and give someone the opportunity to get to know him and almost grow into that captaincy role. But then I had problems because I was out of the doping pool. World Rugby said I had to be back in for 6 months before I can play international rugby. So I would have missed the international season or the incoming tours with the Tri Nations and everything, Championship Cup. I said to Annika, listen, I'm not going to make this first, so I don't think it's worth coming back. And then I decided not to do it. Then I got into coaching the next year, and he asked me again, Victor, I want you to come back. I said, but we're a year past already. Why do you want me to come back? And then he said, no, I think you can play another World Cup. And I said, but I'm 36. I'm getting old. And he said, no, you still believe I'm by far the best second row in South Africa. He would love me to come back, even if I just help the younger guys come through. And then we put everything in place. And after a year's coaching, then 2 years later I came back. And the World Cup 2015 didn't work out, but we got close. But there were some good memories coming back, captaining the Springboks again against New Zealand, winning them, beating them in PE. So there are some good memories with that comeback as well.
Last time I saw you, Victor, it would have been a couple of years after that, and I think you had just finished with Northampton. and we were in Monaco. We were at the World Rugby Awards, and it looked like maybe having not enjoyed retirement the first time, it looked like you were going to ensure that you retired, that you enjoyed your retirement the second time. I think you ended up on a yacht with the Princess of Monaco. Was there a story there? Because the next day you didn't remember much of a story. I don't know if you've heard much since.
Yeah, it was a crazy night. We went out to a bar with the prince and the princess, and then with the princess being South African, they invited a few of the South African guys that was there out to the yacht. And I remember walking into my room, telling my wife, I think it was 4:30 in the morning, we just came off the yacht, and she just looked, did you have a good time? I said, does it look like it? I said, I good time. So yeah, I know. Definitely after the second retirement, I was very happy to be retired, and I'm starting to.
Good man. Yeah. Well, look, we've just decided this morning that we're going to be coming to South Africa for the Lions tour next summer. I don't know how we're going to get there, but we'll make it. So
let's hope we can travel. We can all travel.
True.
Think it's going to be a great tournament. I think it's set up with South Africa being world champions at the moment. I mean, there's four great teams that they can combine a great team of. So yeah, I think it's going to be interesting.
Okay. Brilliant. Well, look, when we get down there next year, we'd love to give you a call and you can come on and get your own back and John de Villiers then.
Will be great. And bring your golf clubs with you.
We will, of course. Well, look, the very best of luck. I hope you can catch up with your two young daughters and they keep you on your toes over the next few weeks. And thanks a million again for joining us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. They're ready with the training gear on, so I have to go right now. Yes, guys.
Cheers. Best of luck. Thanks, Victor.
You're listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness.
Okay, Ulster and Ireland player Claire McLaughlin is one of many Irish rugby players who's left spinning her wheels at the moment. But while many are staying at home, she is gearing up and heading into the A&E department of Ulster Hospital in Belfast today. Claire, Dr. Claire, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for joining us. No, thanks for having me.
Tell us, what's the latest in Ulster Hospital?
So it's been weird the past few weeks. So obviously this has been going on for probably over a month now, and it's been a lot quieter in the hospital than pre-COVID. So it's been really quite eerie. I think in the past week it has gotten a bit busier, but it's still nothing on what it was before COVID came. So I guess like before COVID, the A&E department was absolutely rammed full of people. Like there were people sitting in chairs, lying in trolleys, waiting for beds. And now it's pretty empty. Like there are patients coming through and there's sick patients coming through, but nothing like the volume that we had before. So
is that because people obviously aren't out? They're not there's no sport on, so there's no people coming in with injuries, there's no one, I suppose, out at night, so there's not many injuries from that side of things. There's very few people out driving, etc. That's obviously one of the reasons, but is there still a sense that people are afraid to come in?
Oh, definitely. And that's something that we are concerned about, that people are scared to come up with chest pains and with things that are serious medical problems because of the fear of COVID and the fear of getting something whenever they come to hospital. But we're seeing less road traffic accidents, like people coming in with trauma, but we're seeing more like DIY injuries and more people coming off bikes and stuff like that.
Strimmers, people strimming cats. Are they?
I haven't seen any of that yet, but it could come.
I think there's going to be one coming your way soon. There's been a cat strimming.
or is the cat claws your face because you've tried to strim it?
Yeah. So Claire, is it reading between the lines? Is your job is your job easy at the minute then? Should we cancel the NHS clap on Thursday nights?
You know what? Like, it actually feels like we don't deserve that. And I'm not just saying that. This is probably the least busy it's been in A&E over the past few months. And like, there's definitely difficulties with what we're dealing with at the minute. I guess a lot of the problems are logistics. And I guess over the past few weeks, we've been able to kind of iron out a lot of the things that we maybe weren't prepared for at the start of all this. So we've had to restructure the whole department. And it's just a bit difficult with not knowing where things are, that sort of thing. And I guess we've been really quite well staffed as well, with the potential surge coming. We don't really know every day how many patients are going to be coming through the department. So we have had a lot of doctors there, and it's been, sometimes it's been difficult because we've been fighting over work to do. Right. I'm not going to lie. But obviously this could still kick off. It seems like the measures that they've put in place so far have been flattening the curve as such. Like, we haven't seen a massive increase in numbers of patients coming through, but yeah, day to day, it's definitely not as busy as it has been. So I don't feel like we really deserve all that clapping.
if anybody doesn't deserve it, it was us last Thursday, because we were coming home from a walk, me, Anna, and the kids, and we just happened to coincide. We were walking up the street at 8 o'clock, and we got clapped up the road. If anybody doesn't deserve it, it's us.
So good.
You're doing, I'm sure you're doing a great job.
It gives us something to do as well, Claire, because we've not had to.
Fair enough, get you outside.
I can't wait for when it comes around.
Claire, the big chat at the minute is PPE. Is that still an issue, or is that becoming more of an issue?
Like, I haven't seen that really being an issue. We've had enough PPE where we're working at the minute. The only thing I suppose is that it's changed where that we were working part of our shift in the COVID area of A&E and part of it in the non-COVID area. But now it's changed that we work a full shift within the COVID area. And I think that's partly to do with PPE, because we're reusing our visors, but everything else gets disposed of and chucked out, and you just put on a new one for the next patient or whenever you go for your break and come back again. But no, I haven't really seen that we're running out. Obviously, I don't know what it's like across the board and elsewhere, but there seems to be a lot of chat about it, but thankfully I haven't seen us running out or getting short and things yet.
That's great. And what's your home life like then? Are you separated from your husband, or are you taking extreme measures like at home?
Yeah, so my boyfriend lives in Ballymena. And he's living with his parents. So I haven't seen him in about 4 weeks or so. So it's been tough enough not being able to see him. And he left me up like a care package with a bottle of wine and crisps and sausage rolls and stuff the other day. And it was so nice. Yeah. It was so nice coming home and seeing that outside the door and like a wee card and all. So
bring up. Yeah, masks, advisors, the care package in the future.
Yeah, the essential things.
We should get you one of those Julie Cooper books. You'd love them. They're great.
What's that?
One of my porno books.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah.
We'll get him to include that next time. And how about, are any of your colleagues working down in the south at all? Do you know if there's much of a difference between hospitals up north and in the south?
I was chatting to one of the girls, Claire Cuhan, who's on the Irish squad. So she was final year medical student, and they've kind of been drafted into the hospitals now. So she's been working, basically helping out, doing bloods and things, doing what they can, I think, as final year medical students. And it seems like it's pretty similar from the point of view that things aren't as busy as would be expected at this point. But even looking at the numbers, like north and south, with number of cases and deaths and stuff, I've kind of been keeping an eye on that. And it seems like we're on a similar sort of trajectory with where we're going with the number of cases and deaths. So it seems that the measures that Ireland as a whole are putting in place seem to be working. So we just need to keep that up for a wee while.
Keep it up. Yeah.
Yep.
I hear you. How about training at the moment? Are you getting much time to do any exercise and keep on top of that?
Yeah, so this is obviously the off season at the minute, and we don't really know when we're going to be back in. We were due to be coming back together in the middle of June and have like a full summer program and have like a tour away to the US, but that's all been cancelled for now. There's World Cup qualifiers in September, so I think they're going to be postponed, and we don't know when that's going to be. There's a bit of uncertainty with it all. So with this being the off season, we've been given a bit of leeway with whatever training we want to do. We have been given a program that we can follow. So Orla Curran, she's our S&C coach, and she's been really good. She's given us a program with three gym sessions if we want to do them. There's options for body weight or if you do have equipment, and then running sessions. And then each week we do like a weekly challenge on a Wednesday. So we all come together on Zoom, and usually it's great because it's a bit of competition. So you're doing like loads of exercises for time, see who finishes quickest, and Orla's there watching in the corner, so you know you can't hide. So yeah, trying to get a bit of training in. I guess for me, this is a good time to try and get rehab, because I've only played 2.5 games of rugby this season. I had an ankle injury last May, and it's kind of been at me throughout the season. And this is probably, in a selfish sort of way, this coronavirus has come at a good time where I'm not being tempted to go back to rugby too quickly again. So I'm just focusing on trying to do as much rehab as possible.
Yeah, I reckon there's a lot of players in that situation where they're, you know, taking this time to rest a lot of sore bodies, because it's rare that you get this opportunity. As you said, you always feel like you're missing out if you're injured, yeah, and you're trying to push yourself to get back, and someone else is excelling as you're missing out. So totally. I think across the board, rugby players must be just, you know, healing, I suppose, a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because I don't think you would have this, even in, if you got to the end of the season, you had the off season, you really only get a few weeks and then you're back into it again. So with the not knowing, it kind of does give us a bit more freedom to work on the niggles and get ourselves back to as good as we can be before the off season starts, or before the pre-season starts again.
What about, you were chatting to Pat before, Claire, your mum and dad are up isolating at their farm in Balmoney. Everybody's staying safe that end?
Yeah, they're all good. They're just coming to the end of the lambing season now, so they've pretty much been isolated at home for the past couple of months anyway. They seem really well, so they're all good.
You must have thought growing up in Balmoney, when it comes to ladies sport in Balmoney, you must have thought, this is me, I'm owning this. And then Katie Mullen came along and started
raging, absolutely raging. Yeah. I know, I was like, this is great. Like, Balmoney's such a small place. I know, I know Katie quite well, and she's great. She's done really well with her hockey. So, no, fair play to her.
Yeah, good. That's good. So anyway, you're keeping fit. Everybody's keeping safe, and you're saving lives, Katie. So I know you're saying it's not quite as busy as you thought, but everybody's very proud of what you and Jamie Cairns. We had Jamie Cairns, the Munster doctor, on the show a couple of weeks ago as well, and everybody's doing an incredible job. So we're all very proud of what yous are doing.
Thanks. It honestly doesn't feel like we deserve it, and being called hero, that just doesn't quite sit right with me somehow. But yeah, hopefully this just continues on and it just bumps along rather than like going off the charts, and we can just deal with it every day, and hopefully it doesn't get as bad as some of the other countries that are really struggling with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the meantime, we understand you're an avid penguin, so we're gonna keep talking as much wallop as we can and keep
great.
You going.
Right? That sounds great. Keep it coming.
We'll do our bit. We'll do our bit. They're just different. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for joining us, Claire. And
no problem.
The very best of luck. Keep it up.
Thanks very much. All right. See you.
COVID-19 or coronavirus is here. By taking a few simple steps, we can slow the virus down and help protect everyone. Wash your hands more often, for at least 20 seconds with soap and water. If you cough or sneeze, use a tissue or cover your mouth with your elbow, then bend the tissue and wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose and mouth. and keep surfaces clean. Distance yourself at least 2 metres, 6 feet away from other people, especially those who might be unwell. Stop shaking hands or hugging when saying hello or greeting other people. For updated factual information and advice, go to hse.ie or call 1850 24 1850. Protection from coronavirus. It's in our hands.
Okay, welcome back. And we just want to give a big shout out to Claire's boyfriend, Johnny, who we just realized Pat has blocked him on Twitter over some sort of naive spat that they had back in the day. So Pat has agreed to unblock you, Johnny. So feel free to send some fresh abuse to Pat's Twitter account.
Unblock and follow.
Follow. Yeah. I want to see evidence of this. Okay, over the weekend, we gave you your classic homework to do. So each week we're discussing a new movie or a classic movie and a classic album and a rugby match. We've already discussed the Lions versus South Africa Test 2 in 2009. But our album of the week, now I think there's been a little bit of confusion between the two of us here. It's a Cranberries album. Did you look at Everyone Else Is Doing It, So Why Can't We? Or did you look at No Need to Argue?
No Need to Argue.
Oh, great. Okay. Because we were referencing Linger a while ago. And that obviously wasn't on this album.
That's fine. It was just more of a, it was just more of a link to the Cranberries in general.
Yeah. And to be fair, first time I ever heard the Cranberries was Linger, and still one of my favourites, and I do love that album. But the reason we chose this album, which is because Zombie, this week, the video of Zombie has surpassed 1 billion views on YouTube, becoming only the third ever song to do that, which joining Queen, Bohemian... Is it Queen? I'm not sure what song. It's a Queen song. And I think Bon Jovi, presume Living on a Prayer. So an incredible achievement for a Limerick band, Limerick and Irish band. And going back and listening to those two albums, what are your memories of them?
I wasn't a massive Cranberries fan when I was a youngster, but my sisters were. They're a little bit older than me. So I used to go into... my sister's room. I had two sisters. Mm-hmm. One listened to the good music and one listened to poor music. I haven't take that. Gotcha. But I went into the cool sister's room and stole her CDs. And one of the CDs I regularly stole was Cranberries. And then I was hooking around. She used to give off to me and we'd fall out a bit. And then hooking around looking for more CDs, and then I found her cigarettes. As soon as I found her cigarettes, then I owned her. I was getting whatever CDs I wanted at that stage, so I had free reign.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, Cranberries. I wasn't massively into it, but it was.
So did she used to sit out at the window, do you reckon, and smoke her fags listening to Cranberries in kind of a downtrodden, grungy kind of way, black eye makeup.
Yes. Yeah.
Straightened hair.
Yeah. She was.
Get out of my room.
Yeah. She was probably less clean cut than the other sister. Like she would have been. She'd have hung out with skaters and surfers and.
Bit of a smell out of her room.
But yeah, she was a bit crusty.
Yeah. My crusty brother's room was stinks, man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
incense. She'd have been burning incense as well.
Gotcha.
She's a bit of a hippie.
Okay, that's what I think a lot of the crowd that the Cranberries appealed to back then.
Yeah,
and Dolores herself was kind of, I think, that kind of character, and you could sense a lot of that in her lyrics. She was probably 19. Actually, she was 20 when she wrote this. 21, because there's a song in it called 21. When she wrote this album, which is mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's and mental, yeah.
Even more mind-blowing than when she wrote, you know, the first album that she was only 17, 18.
Yeah.
Some of the depth that you find in the songs, like Ode to My Family, which is probably my favourite one on it. Zombie is about the Troubles, and in particular, I think a bombing in Warrington in 1993 where two children were killed. and to have written about it in such a creative and passionate way is just for someone that young. And I remember my brother has a podcast called The Chat with Dan Murphy, and he got Noel from the Cranberries on last year to talk about their latest album. And he was telling a story about the moment she walked into the room with Zombie recorded on a cassette tape and playing it for them for the first time. But it was obviously just her with her acoustic guitar at home playing. And back then they used to just, they were so inexperienced. They just play in a little recording studio. And they had, you know, if you listen to the first album, it was a lot softer sounding, not heavy guitars. And she came in and she was like, I need you to crank everything. Turn the distortion up. He didn't even have a distortion pedal. He'd go buy one. Fergal, the drummer, was like, I'm just going to play as hard as I can. So she knew exactly what she wanted from it. Wanted it to be kind of, I suppose, really harsh and powerful and almost depicts what war would be like, essentially. So yeah, look, if you go back and listen to it, it's just I don't know, it's a journey, the whole album. Incredible.
You know, I found out when I was looking this up, the first album didn't really land, and then they toured and they were supporting Suede. And halfway through the tour, then they got picked up. MTV started playing Linger, must have been then.
Yeah.
And then they swapped it round and Suede got ditched. Or Suede were like the support act for the rest of the tour.
No way.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah, I think they weren't, it flopped when it first came out, and then it got picked up by college radio in America.
Yeah.
Dreams, I think, was played on some TV show, and that catapulted them. We did a cover of Dreams and Zombie last year, or a couple of years ago, the year Dolores died, and in King John's Castle, there's a cool video of it on YouTube. And we invited the Cranberries to the gig because we knew we were going to do it. It was our first hometown gig since she passed away, and we were rearranging Dreams to do it as, you know, we wanted to put our own little spin on it, and we were arranging it. My brother told me to do a harmony at the end of it. It's kind of like a counter melody. Like, she's unbelievable at writing melodies, basically. I think, like, if you listen to any of these songs, like 21, listen to the melodies that she comes up with at the end of that song, which are kind of like over the lyrics. They're absolutely unbelievable. So there's these kind of melodies at the end of Dreams that's like da 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 da. And then there's this weird,
that sounds a bit like whenever I was playing the bass to that Lenz song.
We're jamming. I won't allow you to do that ever again. But someone comes in with this Native American style, kind of like a yodel at the end, if you listen to the track. And we were listening to it going, who is that? It must have been a sample or something like that that they got. And we did it on the night, and I did that part. And after the gig, we were having a few beers in Dolan's bar in Limerick, and the Noel from the Cranberries was there. And I was talking to my cousin. I was like, and he was like, that melody you were doing at the end is pretty interesting. And I was like, I told him, I think it's like a Native American or something like that. And he was like, he's fucking right there, man. Just go over and ask him. So I went over and I was like, Noel, I hope you enjoyed it. And he's such a Limerick head, man. He's like, yeah, I don't often cry. And, I didn't cry tonight, but I almost cried. Like, that's good enough for me. And I was like, do you know that melody at the end? What was that? Do you mind me asking? And he said, Dolores was going out with a fella from Tipperary around the time. And he was a fucking lunatic. And we were inside in a recording studio one day, and he just started doing this shamanic call to the like shamanic gods or something like that. And he started doing this thing. And she was like, I want this to be recorded. And they were like, oh my God, this is the Yoko Ono moment or something. But they allowed him do it. And all of a sudden it was on the track and it's in there. And it's one of my favorite parts of the song. Now, I know that wasn't on this album, but I still think it's a cool story. So yeah, brilliant album. Have a listen. Congratulations to the Cranberries. And what a legacy Dolores has left behind. reaching 1 billion views on YouTube. Incredible talent. Mm. Now, you chose our movie of the week, and that is Groundhog Day, one of my favorite films ever, by Bill Murray, starring Bill Murray. Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, I've noticed recently people more and more, like, Groundhog Day is an expression now. It's not a movie, or it's a comment, or it's like to sum something up quickly. Yeah, she's Groundhog Day.
Yes, it is. Yeah,
and everybody's so familiar with what that means. Oh, geez, isolation is like Groundhog Day, and everybody keeps saying it. And so I kind of thought, right, well, I thought it was going to be in that category of kind of appropriate movies for us to watch, like Contagion, we both watched as well. Frighteningly accurate.
Absolutely.
Scary. And then we've both
don't watch that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good though.
Doesn't leave you with a good taste in your mouth.
And then I realized I don't think I've ever watched I watched it last night, obviously Groundhog Day. I don't know if I've ever watched it fully from start to finish. I think I've just seen bits of it or dropped in and it's been on TV, because I'm familiar with lots of bits of it, but I've never watched it in its entirety.
Right.
And yeah, it's I don't know if I massively loved it or massively enjoyed it.
Really?
It's so, like, Bill Murray, it is nothing without Bill Murray. He's everything. Like, he is so dry, so sarcastic, so funny. And it just completely collapses without him, so it's totally reliant.
But I think that's why they set up the film like that. So they set it up being a fairly normal kind of bland old time with, you know, they can't have it, you know, they want it to be a boring boring world that he lives in. And I think Tom Hanks was actually supposed to be the one that played Phil Connors originally. Oh, really? But he wasn't as much of a dickhead. He wasn't enough of a dickhead.
Yeah.
So they got, but I think that's my take. And you're right. Bill Murray, he's like my favorite actor of all time. When around this time he'd done Ghostbusters, he'd done Caddyshack, What About Bob? Some of my favorite films. But this, I think Pat said earlier on that he potentially should have won an Oscar for it. And
so what year was this? 93.
93. Yeah.
93. So who did win the Oscar that year? I don't suppose you know. Off the top of your head.
No. Nope. I'd say maybe Dances with Wolves. Did he win an Oscar, Kevin Costner? Maybe he didn't. I don't know.
No.
It's so clever. Blind Boy from Rubber Bandits was on about this recently.
Heard this. Yeah.
Yeah. He's talking about it as an example of how to live like a Buddhist. And how the Buddhist teachings, which, did you listen to that show?
That's what put it in my head. That was about a month ago or a few weeks ago anyway. That's what put it in my head initially. He had a whole...
Oh, it was back at Christmas. It was before Christmas.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
He had a whole kind of like a philosophical approach to the whole thing, which he maybe potentially overthinking things a little bit, but I had that in my head when I was watching it.
Mm. Well, I think like in our current climate... If you look at it, and it kind of inspired me that, you know, the journey that Phil Connors, like, I think everyone should watch it. It's such a brilliant film. The journey that he goes on, he's obviously a bit of a dickhead, gets stuck in this rut of the same day, living every day, and it's this mundane, weird little town, and they're having the Groundhog Day. And then he starts overindulging, realizing that there's no consequences. So he starts... Like, so now we're at home, we're doing nothing. We could just sit in our holes and watch telly and eat food, and we would ultimately be unhappy. Whereas when he starts doing the right thing and applying himself, learning piano, just being kind, being good, he starts to really, I don't know, become living a happier, more enjoyable life. So that's the message, but some of the fucking funniest parts, man. When he's spoofing your one Andy McDowell into trying scoring.
Yeah.
And
it shows how straightforward the initial score with Nancy was.
Yes.
And that's so straightforward. Just find out what school she went to, who her English teacher was, and then that's it, done. And then, as you say, Rita. It's just so long-winded, and he cocks it up so many times.
when he's talking French poetry to her, like, and she, the first time he goes, what did you study in college? And she's like, 18th century French poetry. And he just bursts out laughing and he goes, what a waste of time. And the next night it goes, he's like, he recites this French poem and he wins her over a little bit.
I enjoyed the bit whenever they're making the snowman outside and then he's talking about, oh, I'd love to be able to do this with my kids. And then the other kids start throwing snowballs at him. He's like, are any of you guys up for adoption?
Yeah, he starts totally losing his mind a little bit and he's overdoing it. So, yeah. But look, I think there's it's a hilarious film, but there's also a good message in it as well. Mm. Let's be like, apply ourselves and be sound.
Yeah.
So yeah, get on it, watch it. So
that's the overriding message. Be sound, be dead on, be nice. But I still prefer Bill Murray when he's being sarcastic and dry and a dick to everyone.
Yeah, I did enjoy being a dick. He's so funny.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know what is? Do you know what I also love? Your man Ned Ryerson.
Yeah.
He's like the biggest pothole on the planet. Like, do you know, we all have met that guy that you're like, oh Jesus Christ, this fella, and we're all just too nice to him and too nice, and
he reverse potholes him.
He reverse potholes him. Like, remember Geordie Murphy used to do this, where if like, after a match, there's nothing worse than someone coming up talking to you about the game when you've played shit or something, and they try and tell you what you should have done or something, and you're just like, I'm trying to have a point, would you go away? And Geordie Murphy used to try and make them go away by reverse potholing them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what he does. He starts hugging Ned Ryerson, getting real up on him, and Ned's like, yes.
Yeah. Ferg McFadden used to do that as well. The World Cup 2011, we were at an event there, very potholy, and Ferg and someone else, forget who it was, they're like, we are going to town on this pothole. Like, the guy was actually backing up and Ferg was keep coming at him.
Ned Ryerson.
Eventually he just sickened him of him, and then that was it was easy.
That guy is an incredible character in that film. Yeah. Well done. The guy Egon from Ghostbusters, Harry Ramis, he directed the film as well.
And he's
a doctor in it as well. Very impressive. Okay, that's loads. Trimby, back to Penguins of the Week. As I mentioned earlier, Mark Hill is there. What do we do here? Do we have to make two?
He is flying, isn't he?
Two Penguin Awards?
Well, he's won it 2 weeks in a row, hasn't he?
Yeah, but his latest installment was one of the best I've ever seen.
It's incredible, yeah.
Yeah.
The other guy, Matt McKnight, though, he's had a few big moments as well. He's put up a few of these. And he's got a real style, actually, with his animations, hasn't he?
Yeah, very much so. It's a bit subtle.
Yeah.
Our Facebook group has been kicking off majorly, so thanks and welcome to anyone that's just recently joined our Facebook group. Some great pictures and links, etc.
Keep them coming.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we're doing a good job out there. We're keeping people's spirits up. We're just trying to distract people from what's going on. And then in turn, we are getting distracted by some of the stuff being sent into the group. So thanks.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thanks so much. There's some great stuff.
Yeah. So have we got it? Did you give your Penguin of the Week to anyone?
I think you're right. Mark Hill's hogging it at the minute. But that last one's so good.
But no, we'll give him a separate one. Mark Hill, you're like, you're into the
he's in Hall the of Fame. Hall of Fame. Yes.
Hall of Fame. Right. Okay. So that's your one this week. But the Penguin of the Week is,
it's going to go Matt McKnight then for the tribute to Dumb and Dumber.
Okay. Very. That's
the Penguins in a blue and orange suit.
Yeah. Well done. Round of applause.
Well done, Matt.
Congratulations. Make yourself a toilet roll penguin. Feel free. Okay, that's been more than enough and a brilliant show. Thanks so much to Claire McLaughlin. Thanks so much to Victor Matfield. Thank you to everyone in Joe that has helped put this together. Pat, Paul, Dermot, Anthony. Thank you to everyone for listening and watching us on YouTube. Hello. This has been Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe, together with Guinness. Party on. Stay safe.
You were listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie for the facts.